In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the effect of violence on us as individuals and in our society, and in a particular kind of way. We're not talking so much about what violence means either to victims or to perpetrators, but what we're talking about here in this hour, what we will be talking about, is the effect of violence on people who witness it. And it is true, all too common, that we witness violence every day. It may not be firsthand, but it certainly might. Also, media brings us a great deal of violence. And the question is, what does witnessing that do to us? In what ways can that be harmful? And what can we do about that? And our guest for the program this hour is Dr. Kate Weingarten. She's Associate Clinical Professor in Harvard's Department of Psychiatry, and she's been on the faculty of the Harvard Med School since 1979. She also teaches at the Family Institute of Cambridge and has taught across the country and in a number of other countries outside the United States. She's the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of her book is Common Shock: Witnessing Violence Every Day. It's published by the New American Library. Again, the subtitle is How We Are Harmed and How We Can Heal. It's just out now in paperback. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people who are listening are welcome to call. We just ask people to try and be brief, just so we can keep the program moving along. Dr. Weingarten, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Well, nice to be with you.
Let's talk about the concept here, because I know that it's a term that you came up with as a way to draw some distinctions between other kinds of words that we might use. That, and perhaps what we're talking about here is a matter of degree. So I think you explained that you wanted to, for example, avoid a word like trauma because of all the meanings that are loaded into that.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about things like stress, you know, profound stress disorder for people who are in terrible accidents, people who are in war and things like that. And this is something that is perhaps related and yet different enough so that you wanted to come up with a completely different term to talk about what it is.
Right.
So what is common shock?
I think you really put your finger on it. This is not a medical condition, and more really across the planet, people are exposed to violence. And the reactions that they have, that they know they're having, they can feel it in their body, they can tell because of the way they treat other people, just, you know, the way they walk around during the day, they know they've been shook up. And they've had what I am calling common shock, because almost any place you go on the earth, when people have witnessed and you're asking them about the experience, kind of act out something that looks like a shock. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter whether you're in Africa or in Europe or in the United States. It's an incredibly common experience these days. And as you said in your intro, we're exposed through the media, something that can happen 7,000 miles away can appear in our kitchen almost instantaneously.
Mm. And it's the kind of thing, it can come to us through the media, because obviously there's violence in the world. But you're saying that this can encompass a range of experiences, and you can imagine some of them, anything from maybe witnessing a really terrible car accident, which may be not all that common, but also people in their daily interactions with one another. It's the case of, say you're in line at a store and somebody in front of you is just unnecessarily rude, unkind, verbally abusive to the person who is serving them. Or maybe you have seen, and I'm sure a lot of people have seen, parents doing something that we might all agree was abusive to their children. You know, the parent who's unhappy with a child, and they're out in the parking lot in the supermarket, and they smack them because and a lot of other kinds of experiences. These little, you know, and one could say, well, you know, that's a small thing. And yet your argument you're making is that it does have an effect on the person who is just watching, not in any way other than just watching involved, and that maybe it also has a cumulative effect, that over time, if you get enough of that, that it does add up.
Absolutely. You know, we're very, I think, savvy these days, at least in this country, about what it means to be a victim of violence and also what it means to be a perpetrator. We're really clear about that. We're much less clear about the fact that we are much more likely to be exposed to violence in the witness position, and whether it's from a distant event that's not really near us or in our sphere, or it's in our home, it's on our street, it's in our playground, it's in our store, that far and away we are going to experience violence through the witness position, and it will have effects. For some people, they really notice that they're jarred, and other people are numbed out by it. And if you think about what it means to be in a society where so many people chronically exposed to violence are walking around numb, that's a big problem for us.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there are people who have the following kind of reaction. They might say, well, I can see your point. And yet they might say something like, but. When you look at the kind of really traumatic experiences that some people do have in life, and you compare them to the kinds of common shock that many of us encounter as we're going through our lives, they would say, well, now, it's our community. There's no war being fought in our community. There are nobody's blowing themselves up in our neighborhood. Nobody's taking our children hostage at their school. The kinds of things that we might be exposed to along these lines, whether it be coverage of those sorts of events or the kind of things that we talked about, the few examples, mm-hmm. I'm sure that people would say, well, is it really, you know, when you look at what real trauma could be, and then you look at common shock, they might say, almost, is that even worth talking about? Just because of the, you know, because of the big difference between those two things.
Sure. And I'm very happy that we are talking about the major kinds of events that do produce trauma for people. I think that's critically important, and we've been doing that successfully for about 20 years. We have not successfully found a way of talking about the effects of witnessing violence, and that is a problem for us. If we live in communities where people read the front page of the paper and then they put it down and they can't look at it, we will not have an effective citizenry. And if we are exposed to people who are behaving badly on streets or in playgrounds, and we also numb out, we're not going to have an effective citizenry. And that's a problem that has to be addressed.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Kate Weingarten. She teaches at Harvard University. She's an associate clinical professor in Harvard's Department of Psychiatry. The book, if you'd like to look at it, that discusses this matter is titled Common Shock, Witnessing Violence Every Day, How We Are Harmed, How We Can Heal. And that's published by the New American Library, and it's just out in paper. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I wonder, maybe you could talk a little bit more about the effects of witnessing violence. Again, the effects of common shock. And I guess we've talked about one, either that you get to the point where you don't feel anything, mm-hmm. or maybe it's that you feel that you feel too much.
Right. Well, I think there are effects that people feel in their body, and those are familiar, usually pathways that people have. They know when they feel stressed. Sometimes people have pains in their neck. Sometimes people are affected in their stomach. People can get tingling in their hands. People have instantaneous physical reactions in their bodies that they have no control over. Second, there are psychological or emotional responses that sometimes occur right away, and sometimes people have delayed responses. So it runs a gamut from irritability to being more aggressive, in the next interaction to being impulsive to feeling completely spacey. When you put people together who have gone through a whole day being exposed to violence, and then you put them at the dinner table, and you have somebody who's spacey, somebody who's irritable, somebody who's aggressive, that can produce problems in the interaction in a family. And I think most people are familiar with how scenes unfold that way.
In the book, you talk about the fact that there are, if you look at all the possible kind of situations that a person could be in as a witness, that you could be have situations either where a person is really very aware of the fact of what they're witnessing and that they're or that they're not, or maybe it's being really conscious of the violence that they're witnessing or not, and then there's another dimension of this, and it has to do with the individuals and their perhaps their feeling whether or not they can do anything about it.
I guess
it's probably easier to understand the person being in the position that they're perfectly aware of what it is that they're witnessing. How is it that one cannot be aware?
I think sometimes chronic exposure to low-grade violence and violation becomes like the wallpaper. It's just there, and you don't notice it. Certainly, I spent 15 years as the clinical director of a sexual abuse evaluation and treatment team, and we had many family members coming in who said that until there had been a television documentary or a conversation with a neighbor, they had no idea that what was happening in their family was other than how things should be. So it is certainly possible for people to be unaware. As you point out, it's very different to be aware and to feel affected in relation to what you're seeing, and to be aware and to feel helpless. And more, I think people, young children, and adults feel perfectly aware but helpless to do anything about the violence that's either local or global.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the things that, that researchers and people who have looked at the subject of violence and the kind of effect that it has on people, and maybe particularly this has to do with how much violence you're exposed to in the media, is that one of the things that it will do is that it will affect the way that you look at the world and whether you think either basically the world is a good place or a bad place. You know, is the world a safe place or is it a dangerous place? Mm-hmm. And I would think that you would be in agreement with those people that say, well, the more violence to which you are exposed, the more that's going to give you the idea that, in fact, the world is a dangerous place. It is a bad place. Stuff like this happens all the time. And if particularly you're often in this position where you feel that you can't do anything about it, I would say that all of that would end up giving the person a very sort of hopeless kind of negative view of life and of the world that might even then make it less likely that they would even think about trying to be engaged and intervene, because they would have this attitude that, well, it doesn't matter what anybody does. That's just the way the world is.
Right. That's a very good point. By age 12, if we just look at television alone, the average American child has seen 8,000 murders and 100,000 acts of violence. Surely no 12-year-old living his life in real time is going to see 8,000 or even 8 murders, most likely, by age 12. So it's very unrealistic, and it does create a distortion in the perception of what the world is like and what a child or a person can do in that world.
And so and as you're toting up the kinds of experiences that can contribute to common shock, in addition to actual violence that a person might witness, or maybe news coverage of actual violence, you're also including simulated violence, the thing that people see in you're talking about violent entertainment, video games, movies, television, stuff like that.
Yes. I mean, that's a very well-researched area. This book doesn't focus particularly on that, but that's certainly a big part. I think the other area that where it's important to look at exposure to everyday violation is around medical issues and medical care. There is no family in this country. There's no family anywhere in the world who doesn't have a family member or relative who has, you know, who hasn't had a serious illness. Serious illnesses are very difficult on the person who's suffering, but they're also really difficult on the people who are watching the sufferer, that is, the people who are in the witness position. And more people are feeling quite helpless in relation to advocating for their loved ones in the healthcare system. So that's another place where people are witnesses and often feel helpless and ineffective. Hmm.
We have a caller to talk with, and let's do that on our line number one. The caller's in Lovington. Hello.
I agree with you about the TV. I'm 40 years old, and I don't think I've seen probably 6 dead bodies outside of a funeral home in my whole life, and definitely never seen a murder. And I guess I'm getting old and fogish, but I can't even hardly stand to watch TV anymore because, you know, it's unpleasant to watch all that violence. I just wonder, maybe this isn't your area, but who or what all this violence and entertainment serves?
You're making a really important point that it's certainly very unpleasant for a lot of people. Clearly, it serves commercial interests. A lot of people are very interested in this kind of entertainment, so it does sell ads, which generates revenues. Sex and violence, those are the two big kind of theme categories of most entertainment.
I think it's interesting that our society objects so much to anything sexual, but violence is, I don't know if you can watch an hour of TV if you watch the three major stations that you wouldn't see some kind of violence, but that's all I had to say. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks. Anything further you want to comment on, Dr. Weingarten?
I just agree with your caller.
Okay. Other people who are listening, you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, you certainly can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's the number to call. And then if you would be listening around Illinois, Indiana, or if you would happen to be listening over the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We're talking a little bit earlier about how a big load of common shock could affect a person's view of the world, you know, the way that they look at the world and how they think about what kind of a place it is. Do you see ways in which this has an effect, a real kind of effect on individuals in their day-to-day relations with one another? You know, how it is that one person simply relates to somebody else in their common daily interactions?
Yes, and that's, you know, takes me back to my dinner table example. People who are exposed to violence in a family, it's, you know, it would be unlikely that everybody would respond in the same way. So now what you're dealing with is people who have different styles of responding to being everyday witnesses, and they have to relate to each other. And it can be very chaotic and complicated. So it certainly does have potential in families for being very difficult, especially since, as you say, these are often experiences that are kind of off the radar screen. You know, people may not even be aware that when they were driving the car and they were stopped at a red light, that they were bothered by seeing a argument on the street. You know, it may not even register. So to some extent, we are subliminally affected by violence, which is all around us. And then we come back, and we don't really understand why. We just feel crummy or irritated or annoyed.
Let's go on. We have someone in Chicago to bring in. Let's go to line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I was very interested in your comment that violence becomes like part of the wallpaper, because one thing that struck me and I guess appalled me was the reaction of even people who are supposedly religious people to the photographs from Abu Ghraib. There was a lot of rationalization and statements that, like, we still have the moral high ground, relativism. it was just people really didn't seem to be shocked and appalled and mortified. And I can only assume that we are becoming immune, or but somehow we simply aren't seeing how incredibly repulsive that whole situation was. And there's even one defense attorney who said that his client had done nothing wrong. And what frightens me is that we're the society that produced that process of torture, and these people will come back into our society. And maybe our ideas will continue of what is violent and what is will continually decline, and so that more and more things become acceptable.
Mm-hmm. I think you're making a very important point, which is when there's so much exposure to violence, does it lower the bar for what's acceptable? And what does it mean that as a society, the community, our community was really split as to whether or not those photographs and the actions that they represented were justifiable because of a political situation we had created, or whether they were absolutely repugnant and represented a massive injustice. And I think the other point to be made here is that violence is almost always embedded in a politics, whether it's a family, politics of the family life, or the politics of between nation states. And that often does create justifications for acts that are reprehensible and dangerous.
And I guess my follow-up question to this is, I thought that sometime, and this would have been some time ago in the 70s, they had done studies in South Africa of people that were in the apartheid police force that were involved in torturing the African prisoners, and what happened when they came home, the effect of violence in the home. Do you know anything about those studies or similar studies where they look at people who are professionally engaged in acts of violence and torture, and how that relates when to their experience in the home? I think the study in South Africa found that domestic violence increased.
Well, again, I mean, it's an interesting point. I think in the South African context, I'm aware of sort of two groups of studies. One makes the point that you're making, which is that political violence tends to be associated with higher levels of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. But the other point that's made about the apartheid situation is that people who committed horrific crimes within the political sphere could also take off their uniforms, literally take off their gloves, and be, kind, charming citizens and family men. And one of the things that came out during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings was people kind of giving testimony to what they had to go through to make that kind of transition from being a brutal murderer and torturer in one setting and then being, you know, a sweet, kind father in another, and that took an enormous toll out of them. Of course, it also took an enormous toll out of the nation, which is still recovering.
I guess my question is, I feel that sometimes the ability to be aggressive means that you have to identify one group as vulnerable, and then you also see that people who are vulnerable are not worthy of compassion, but in some extent your disgust, and you're able not to feel compassion. And I wonder how that affects the society as a whole, and probably even minor things where you don't feel compassion for this person who's vulnerable because you see them as someone who's just simply not worthy. And I guess I just sort of feel that there's like a slippery slope into evil, and most of the time we're not going to see something really horrific, but we're going to see these small injustices that have an accumulative effect.
Mm-hmm. The process that people kind of look at is a process that's called dehumanization. And what is amazing about the human brain is that we are able to select some groups of people to dehumanize and others who we do not ever dehumanize. So, you know, one of the things that we have to understand is how does it happen that one group of people can be dehumanized by another, and yet other people are don't undergo that process of degradation and devaluation. So we behave one way with the people we respect, and we behave in incredibly cruel ways for the people we've dehumanized, because we do not believe they deserve any better. Mm-hmm. They're bugs.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just some of the things we've talked about so far in your conversation with the caller, again, it raises in my mind that the issue of how difficult it is for people to in a sense, compartmentalize their lives, to say that, okay, so maybe I have had these experiences, I have witnessed this kind of violence, but we're going to keep it over here in this place, and it's not going to come home with me, or it's not going to come into my relationships with my partner and my children and my friends. That you can't do that. It's all of one piece, and you can't keep things in separate little rooms like that.
But people do. And one of a group of studies that are particularly fascinating are the studies of people during World War II in Germany, the SS officers and Nazi officers, and influenced by propaganda, where they saw the Roma people, Jews principally, as vermin, and therefore they were completely dehumanized, which then psychologically justified inhuman treatment. These same people were often particularly courtly and kindly in their behavior with people who they viewed as human. So the human brain, unfortunately, is absolutely capable of compartmentalizing. And we do it through a process of saying, these people are not really people. They're other.
I would expect that sort of going back to this idea that when you're witnessing violence, you can be in one of several categories, depending upon how aware you are and whether you feel you can do anything about it.
Right.
And that I can imagine maybe the most difficult, in a way, the most stressful sort of position to be in is when you're aware and feel that you can't do anything about it.
Right.
But then the question becomes, well, if you want to be in the position that says, not only am I aware, I'm going to do something. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, what do you do?
Well, you know, I think as adults, we've had the experience working with children or with children we know, or we're parents. We do this all the time. The children are aware of things that disturb them. They're, you know, for them, life, the world can be a very scary place, sometimes very violent. Children who wake up in the middle of the night with nightmares, children afraid to go to bed at night because they're afraid of horrible creatures in their rooms, and they've got very violent scenarios. We have learned to help them feel effective in relation to that. So these are ideas that I think most people are walking around with, that if you are with a child who's feeling helpless, that it's important to help the child feel that they can do something about it. And I've been amazed at how inventive and creative people are often with their children in helping turn that around. So a child who is being bullied and comes home and either asks a parent, or sometimes, you know, I'll ask a teacher, what can I do? Adults are really clear. There are things to be done, and people know how to be helpful. Well, in a sense, we have to do the same thing with ourselves. First of all, we have to be aware that we are being exposed to violence. We have to realize that it's happening. Second, I think we need to learn, we do something I call a body scan. How does my body react? How can it clue me in to the fact that I'm, you know, weirded out by something that I've been exposed to? And then third, we have to learn what our emotional response is. Do we withdraw? Do we become irritated? Do we become aggressive? So those are sort of part one. Then we can begin to take care of ourselves. Another category of response is to say, gee, am I safe? And what resources do I have? And to kind of do an inventory of the kinds of resources we do have to identify a problem and see what we're going to do about it. It usually means breaking down a category of something we're distressed by that's often huge and overwhelming, and breaking it down into smaller units so that we can do something about it. And then finally, Americans are very used to going it alone and solving our problems ourselves. We are not going to solve this one on our own. And I think that often the solutions, the what we can do, is that we need to figure out who our allies are and who can help us with the violence that we're exposed to. And we do it together.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Kate Weingarten. She's Associate Clinical Professor in Harvard's Department of Psychiatry, Harvard University. She's been on the faculty of the Harvard Medical School since 1979. She also teaches at the Family Institute of Cambridge and has taught across the country in various places around the world. Her book is titled Common Shock, Witnessing Violence Every Day. It is now available in paperback. It's published by the New American Library. It's just recently come out in paper. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We'll go to another caller here, Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll free line. Hello.
Hi. About dehumanization and insensitivity to dehumanized people, it's instructive to note that when the Supreme Court overturned all the democratically passed laws against abortion, they did it by declaring the unborn baby a non-person. A baby isn't a person until he or she is born. Now, that's obviously all of the intellectuals thought that was very enlightened. We had an The Supreme Court was, and then they celebrated. It was enlightened. And just recently, we have seen three courts of appeal confirm that the law against partial birth abortion was unconstitutional. Now, remember, the baby isn't a person until he's born. But if he's partially born, I guess he still isn't a person. And when the doctor stabs him in the back of the neck and puts his scissors up into that baby's brain, and then puts a without any anesthetic, no anesthetic, and you can tell the baby's feeling the pain. He can't scream because his head isn't born yet. Because if his head were born, then he'd be a person. But you see, when the doctor inserts that cannula inside his brain, the baby acts as if he's feeling terrible pain, and sucks his brains out. But that's enlightened. I mean, you have to understand. And after all, he's not a person until he's fully born, is he?
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that, you know, this is something that you obviously feel very passionately about. At the same time, your description was very graphic, and I would wonder whether some of the people who are listening were having a common shock experience, were finding themselves cringing or just very disturbed by hearing your description. Not that it shouldn't be so vivid, but it was very vivid, and my guess is that there are some people who went, oh, this is too much for me.
Well, what obviously here it is something that the caller is very concerned with, and I don't want to say it's not worth discussing, but I guess I want to say I think that's another program. I guess it gets us back, though, to the point of the book. I mean, I'm sure there are probably some people, when they heard the voice of the caller, they turned their radios off and they're not listening to us anymore. But it just gets us back to the basic question of, well, what does one do? I mean, and how do you confront that? And it may well be, as often happens when we get a subject like this, someone else will want to call in and say they think that the particular caller is wrong and lay out their point of view on the issue. And I suppose that's one thing that one can do. But I guess it does get back to the question about, well, okay, so yeah, that we do witness violence. So what do we do about it?
Right. In this case, what I would want to call our attention to is what happens when there's very graphic language and you're listening to it but didn't know it was going to happen. And as you point out, for some callers, it may have crossed a threshold and they just turn off the dial. I mean, they in a sense, they're taking care of themselves. They do know that they can't handle it, and so they turn it off, and that's a very appropriate response. Then there are other people who are listening to it and might be like, you know, well, big deal, you know, who cares? But actually, it is a big deal, and they do care. And it's going to, as you pointed out in your opening remarks, it cumulatively takes a toll.
Well, let's go on to another caller here. Lafayette is next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. To change the tone of the question a little bit, I have been told that in families where there is abuse, that children who witness the abuse of siblings but are too small to be able to do anything about it are possibly more traumatized than the child that is abused. Is that something you would agree with?
You know, the research studies that are being done on child witnesses are relatively recent compared to the studies that have been done on being child victims. So it is the case that the data look like being in the witness position, that is to say, really helpless, you know, a bystander, may actually have more negative long-term consequences than being the targeted child. That is correct.
In what kinds of ways?
The areas that have been studied have to do with academic performance, behavior management kinds of issues, and mood dysregulation. So, and again, you know, the dynamic in the family of siblings quarreling is really not what we're talking about. You know, siblings
Right.
will quarrel. We're really talking about a level of violence which induces almost a level of paralyzing fear in the witness, the child who's witnessing. And again, you know, the parental responsibility is to, first of all, to stop the violence. Second of all, to talk about what's happening. And third of all, to help the child who is in the witness position feel less helpless, that there are things they can do. They can leave the
Right.
room, they can consult, they can talk to a parent, they can talk to another adult, they can tell the perpetrating children, stop it. This really bothers me. This is terrible. I mean, there are all kinds of things children can do. And again, in families, the issue is always safety first.
Unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of adult people walking around who didn't grow up in that era, you know, who, you know, you didn't talk about it, you didn't dare, and, you know, we're in a more enlightened time, thank God, than perhaps, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Right, I think you're right. I think there's less silence about this issue. For instance, the word abuse is a word that most elementary school children have heard, but that was certainly not the case 30 years ago.
Right, right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, and again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I guess one of the things that I find myself coming back to, and again, it gets back to this idea of the difficulty of being an engaged witness, not only just witnessing something, but doing something, taking an action. It's one thing, and it can be difficult, even if you're actually in a position to do something. But it seems that a fair amount of the violence that we might end up witnessing may be taking place, you know, whether we're talking about the hostage taking in Russia, or we're talking about Abu Ghraib, or we're talking about, you know, suicide bombings in the Middle East, or, you know, whatever it is we're talking about, are taking place a long way away, and there's no way that we can, at least not in a really immediate way, there's no way that we can intervene. You know, it doesn't matter whether we feel empowered or not, because it's so far removed. So here, in a sense, we have something that can still have an emotional impact for us, but is so far removed from us that it starts to become really difficult to think about, well, what do you do about that?
I think the lesson of the book that I'm trying to get across is that there are things we can do, and they're proxy measures of the most horrible events or situations that are occurring, even when they're far away. The example that I have is I've done work in South Africa, and I had a series of pictures that I had taken in a orphanage in a township in South Africa of children who had been orphaned by AIDS, many of whom had AIDS themselves. And after I was home, I was showing the photographs of my trip to my goddaughter, who was 8 at the time. And she asked me about the orphanage, and she became very, very sad. In other words, she became aware that some children's parents are dying of an epidemic and that some children will too. And I saw that she became very helpless. I noticed that we had a jar where my husband and I keep our change when we take it out of our pockets. And I suggested to her that we could make a penny roll. We could roll this change, and then we could send it to the orphanage. She thought that was such a good idea that she took some of the pictures that I had, brought them to her second grade classroom, invited other children in her classroom to do the same thing. Her teacher agreed. They brought in their spare change. And it turned out that the children in one classroom in a suburban community raised enough money, it ended up paying for all the funerals that year of the children who died of AIDS in that particular orphanage. So that's an example where from one 8-year-old and one jar of pennies to all the way back to the problem that she had seen. She had made a difference in her classroom, had made a difference, and hopefully those children all now have the idea that you can do something small and it can ripple out and have a big effect.
Well, again, I'd like to introduce our guest for this Barna Focus 580, Dr. Kato Ongarten. She is Associate Clinical Professor at Harvard University's Department of Psychiatry, and she's been on the faculty of Harvard Medical School since 1979. And some of the ideas that we've been discussing here are in her book, Common Shock, Witnessing Violence Every Day. It has just recently come out in paperback. It's published by the New American Library. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about some of your experiences. I know that you've been places like South Africa, you're in Kosovo, and what your thoughts are about here, you know, we're talking about extreme cases, beyond common shock, places that have been really torn by ethnic sectarian violence, and places where they are trying to get past that and put their societies back together and have some kind of reconciliation. What does it take to do that?
Well, again, I would say that, for instance, in Kosovo, more people were exposed in the witness position than were actually victimized themselves by the violence, or certainly had been perpetrators of it. So again, one of the things that does need to happen in situations like that is that people have to understand that there's a reason they feel terrible. One of the things that we did do in Kosovo with school children, with teachers, in schools and in numbers of community settings is give people a concept that when you are a witness to violence, even if it didn't happen to you, you didn't get the rifle butt in your chest, but you saw it, that something did happen to you. So that needs to happen because people have to understand that they have to take care of themselves now. So that's number one. People need to understand that they were witnesses and something happened to them. Second of all, I think communities really have to, in some ways, go through a very difficult process about whether or not they themselves or for the next generation, revenge is the answer, or whether revenge has to stop. And one of my work is very much devoted to helping communities figure out how to intercept or disrupt victim-perpetrator cycles, where the victims in one generation become the perpetrators in the next. And that's really a critical piece of work for any community that has suffered great losses.
Hmm. Well, and it's something that we see a lot. We see in many different places. It's something that I think it's an impulse that is understandable, you know, that people would that might be an initial kind of impulse for people to who have been hurt to want to hurt back. And obviously that's a difficult thing to do because there are an awful lot of places around the world where you do see that sort of cycle of violence and reprisals, and it just seems to keep going and keep going.
Right. People who have lost everything have nothing to lose. And, you know, I recently heard on the radio a term for Chechenian widows called black widows.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe other listeners have too, women who had lost every family member and who had then become suicide bombers. They had nothing to lose. And these are horrific circumstances, but they're very much the dynamic of how somebody who's been profoundly victimized or witnessed terrible, terrible losses can then turn around and become a perpetrator unless there's some process. And in my view, the process isn't personal. The process has to be both personal and communal. These are collective processes of changing the dynamics and saying revenge must stop now.
Well, and I suppose, again, here, we go back to something you said earlier, that it may be that the dehumanization of the other is required for one person to do that kind of violence onto another, and that the difficult thing you have to do is in a sense get across to people that there is no other, that it's sort of all the same,
right.
And that a funeral is a funeral, and a death is a death, and a loss is a loss, and it doesn't matter if it's one of us or it's one of them. You have to get back. You have to get past seeing things in terms of us and them, and in simply seeing in terms of us. That it's really all the same, and yet though that seems something that's very difficult for people to do.
Right, and I think that you've absolutely put your finger on it. And the question is, how do we accomplish that? How do we really get across the message when we've been grievously harmed by other people? That we are all one and the same, and that we're all in the same boat. That's the work. That's the work of the world. It's the work of each of us who lives on the planet right now.
Long term, if we do nothing about common shock, where do we go?
We're going to be in even worse straits than we are now, and. The exposure is proliferating. The means by which exposure occurs is proliferating. And yet our bodies are biologically going to stay the same for hundreds and hundreds, thousands and thousands, perhaps millions of years. We're going to exceed our ability to cope, and we're going to see more violence. So it really is up to each of us, and there are things that each one of us can do to turn it around. To notice that we're witnessing and to try to do something positive about it, not just alone, but with other people.
Well, there we will leave it as we're at the end of the time. And again, for people who would like to read more about the ideas we've been talking about, the book to look for is called Common Shock, Witnessing Violence Every Day by our guest, Kata Weingarten. She's Associate Clinical Professor in Harvard's Department of Psychiatry. The book is published by New American Library and just now out in paper. Dr. Weingarten, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.